Tell me who you are and what you had for breakfast today.
Okay, I'm Nate Smith, and I had 2 eggs scrambled with sausage and wheat toast, and it was delicious. It was delicious. It was everything I dreamed it would be.
What does one dream it to be?
Listen,
were you expecting it to be?
Listen, I had, when I'm in Roanoke, man, it feels like home. My grandmother lived in Salem, so, you know, I think of grandma's breakfast when I'm here. I think of, like, the country and, like, that feeling, you know, when you wake up and you're like, oh, okay. You know, my grandmother was old school, man, up at 5:30 baking biscuits from scratch. She was that one.
I didn't know that you were from Salem.
My mother's from Salem.
Okay.
So I'm from Chesapeake, but we would come to visit Salem often. We'd be here for a couple weeks every summer, and we'd come up for Thanksgiving, you know, every year. So I got to know Salem pretty well.
He went to Detroit when he first got married.
Okay.
And I was born in Detroit.
Okay.
Steve was born in Detroit. Louis was born in Detroit.
Mm.
Then he was drafted into the Army.
Okay.
And that's when Mom came back to Florida to stay with her mother.
Got it.
Uh-huh. And then he came back to, and she had bought a house in Salem.
Mm-hmm.
With a little bit of money he sent every month, she saved up enough to buy a house.
Tell me a little bit about Grandma then.
Irene Helm, my mother's mother, she was a beautiful woman, very funny. She was the type of person that as soon as you walked into her home, she wanted to feed you something. She was known to, out of the blue, order my mom to go in the kitchen and whip up something for people to eat, just out of the blue. We'd be sitting around and there'd be a lull in conversation. She would say, why don't you go in the kitchen and fry about 3 eggs for each, you know, everybody. And that was sort of her thing. It was like everything was about her welcoming you into the house and making you feel at home. She was great. She worked as a domestic for most of her life. And she had 5 kids with her husband, my grandfather, Booker T. Helm. Seems like every black family has a Booker T. Somewhere.
Right?
Yeah. Every black family has a Booker T somewhere in the lineage.
And Booker T. Washington was born literally on a plantation not too far away from where you and I are right now in
really?
Virginia.
Wow.
In Franklin County, just past Rocky Mount.
Wow, I did not know that.
There is a national monument
wow.
to Booker T. Washington.
Indeed.
Nate Smith joins us here on Last Quarter. I'm Josh Jackson. The recording is Kinfolk, Postcards from Everywhere. And congratulations, by the way. I mean,
thank you.
I've been following you for a while and I listened to Water Baby when
mm-hmm.
it came out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think when you were 40, you made like a little mixtape or something.
I did. I've put out, Kinfolk is actually my 4th record. I did all of my records before that have been R&B, like, you know, kind of produced R&B records. So a lot of programming and, you know, I was playing all the instruments. But I did a record called Workday in 2008 and then a record called Scrapbook in 2011. And then when I turned 40, I did this little 40, this 8-track beat tape that I put out, and it's all just been like, you know, something to just put music out, and you know, but this was the first band leader effort, and this is certainly the biggest project I've ever done because there are a lot of people on this record, a lot of folks, you know. So
it is from everywhere.
I mean,
and also everywhere in your own development as an artist. I mean, Adam Rogers, the guitarist, is on this, and you play with him mm-hmm. and a group called Dice. Dave Holland is on this recording.
Absolutely, yeah.
I wanted to back up for just a moment. Since you were talking about your grandmother, it mm-hmm. sort of reminded me of one of the first people that you worked with mm-hmm. in the jazz canon, and that mm-hmm. is Betty Carter.
Yeah, of course.
And I recall also from Water Baby that you did something for her.
Yeah.
There's like this soundbite of her where she's basically saying, like, you have to be an individual
right.
and somebody that people will remember.
Absolutely.
Because cliches are all over the place, and anybody can do that. But if you want to hang in there for a long time, then you have to really be an individual, be something somebody will never forget. I'm on the loose, and I don't dig it.
going on? This is Nicolay of the Foreign Exchange. You're checking out my man, Nate Smith. This is Water Baby. Water Baby. Peace.
You know, there were a lot of lessons that I learned from the brief time I worked with her. I met her in 1996. She passed away in 98. So I didn't have that much time with her. But I did, you know, she was a natural teacher, so you couldn't be around her without learning something, you know, especially if you're a musician, an impressionable musician of that age. Like, you're going to soak up everything she has to say. But she was that, too. She was an individual. You know, I really believe, you know, she said it once, too. In a way, she was the last jazz singer, you know, because she's the link in the chain that ties together, you know, a singer like Sarah Vaughan or Ella to a singer like Cassandra Wilson or even a Gretchen Parlato. I think Betty is that link, you know, and what she did with form, what she did with melody, the liberty she took, the way she was able to stretch and you know, she was just so musical, really unique. So I took that to heart, man. That snippet is from a CBS Sunday Morning profile they did on her, and I'm featured in that profile. That in 1996, I was, I guess, 21 years old when they did that, and it was a trip just to be around her and witness her. It was incredible, you know.
Tell me a little bit about that Jazz Ahead program, because she sort of plucked you out of, I guess, Chesapeake, Virginia.
Yeah, it was through, I did, in the summer of 1995, I did the Disney Grammy band in Epcot. And in that band was a young trombonist named Andre Hayward from Houston. Great trombonist, played with Lincoln Center. I think he lives in Dallas now, but just an amazing musician and really great guy. And he heard me say, listen, you know, Betty should hear you. I just did Jazz Ahead. So, you know, you should, you know, I'm going to tell her about you. And I said, yeah, great, you know. And he did. And the following January, this was July of 95, so January of 96, it doesn't exist anymore, IAJE, there was this conference they used to do every year.
The International Association for Jazz Education.
Right. And so we would do, they would bring different student groups. So my band from JMU got selected to go to IAJE, and Betty was there. And she heard, you know, maybe 10 or 15 minutes of our set, and then she came up to me afterwards. She said, you know, I like the way you play. I want to talk to you about Jazz Ahead. And, you know, and I was like, okay. And, you know, a few months later, I got the call. She was like, I want you to come to New York and play. And the first year I did it was myself, Byron Landham from Philly. There were three drummers, myself, Byron Landham from Philly, and a young drummer from Houston named Eric Harland, who was, I can tell you, Eric sounded every bit as clear, and his ideas were just as beautiful then as they are now.
Were yours?
I don't know. Great question. I don't know. I'd like to hope that I've gotten better. Eric has always been great. He's just gotten more great. I certainly hope that there's a core of my playing, like a personality in my playing that's been there since then, that's still there. I think it has. And I do think that I've certainly learned how to play in different situations much better now since Jazz Ahead. But doing that kind of really changed my trajectory, being in Jazz Ahead, because it exposed me for the first time to musicians my age who were playing at that level. And it just inspired me to work harder, and it really made me think seriously about New York. I flirted and dreamed about the idea of moving to New York and flirted with the idea, but it was just like being in that situation made me know, okay, eventually I got to make this move from Virginia, you know, to New York.
And yet here you and I are in Virginia.
That's
and
right.
Having this conversation. Mm-hmm. Nate Smith, Kinfolk, is performing at the Jefferson Center in Roanoke. And you've also been conducting a workshop or teaching students. Tell me a little bit about what you're doing.
Yeah, so, you know, the Jefferson Center has this really cool music lab that they are using to teach kids about songwriting and production and recording. And it's just a really great resource. It's something I wish I had when I was a teenager, you know, to be surrounded by people who are encouraging you to just kind of examine your curiosity in different parts of the music business, you know. But yeah, so I've been there. Last night I was there, and we were We have three songs that we're working on while I'm here. So there was a singer-songwriter I worked with last night. She's working on a pop record. And then there's this four-piece rock band that I'm working with tonight. And then tomorrow there's a gospel group that we're going to work with. We're going to try to put together a record for each one of them.
Wow.
And I'm going to sort of be producing the record and kind of coaching the kids on how to, you know, perform it. And it's really cool. It's you know, just a nod to Cyrus and Jessica and Jordan, everybody who runs that place. They're really doing something very cool over there, and something that I think these kids can take with them as they, whatever they choose career-wise, they can take this stuff with them, these experiences, and say, okay, I learned something from this, you know? And you just never know what kind of impact you make when you meet a kid at that age. Having been that age and thinking back to when I was, you know, there were a number, even before Betty, a number of just impressions that were made on me by musicians that I think I've always taken with me, you know, like, and I hope I can kind of make some of those impressions on them, you know, that they take with them forward.
Smith joins us. Kinfolk is the band, and Postcards from Everywhere is the recording. Speaking of reflections,
yeah.
I mean, I kind of feel like this entire recording is based on some kind of reflection about who you are, how you've gotten to this point in your 40s, and kind of just looking over your shoulder and figuring out how did I get here and why.
Yeah, no, it is. And I feel like, you know, I released this record at 42, and by the time most cats are my age band leaders, they've released several records, you know. So this is my first band leader record, and it's happening kind of late in my career. So I felt a need to sort of give a little backstory, not only just for my own, you know, expression, but also to get the audience an idea of who I am, where I'm from. And yeah, there was something like around 2012, 2013, I just started thinking about it, like, okay, here I am. How did I get here? What were the choices I made along the way? Who were the people that helped me, you know? And it started to kind of form something. But the music was always kind of the guiding thing. Like, you know, if the music had been about something different, then maybe the record would have had a different tone. But there's a lot of that feeling of nostalgia and narrative in the music. So I wanted it to feel that way throughout the entire project, you know, not only just the way the record sounds, but also the interludes with my parents and the artwork itself. I mean, everything about it is about storytelling.
Let's talk a little bit about Home Free.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why I want to talk about it more than anything is because I think it was right around Father's Day, if not on Father's Day, there was a video that you released.
Yeah.
And at first I looked at it, and in my sort of skepticism I thought, well, it's an EPK, an electronic press kit.
Right.
It's about this record.
Right.
And then by the end of it, I had goosebumps. Mm. And I thought, no, actually, I think this might be a remarkable piece of citizen journalism.
Right. Right.
And it just so happens to be that you have a recording.
Right.
And it's about the men in your life.
Yeah, it is. About particularly two of them, my father and grandfather. The song was written for my grandfather. And over the course of the recording of my record, my father passed away. So it just felt like a befitting tribute, that the song takes on a dual meaning. It's not just about Peter Joe. It's about Dad, too. And there's an interlude on the album just before the song that features my dad talking about his dad. So there is this, you know, I just felt like a sort of convergence. And for me, the film was directed by this great director, Jim McGorman from Philly. And I worked with him. He did a documentary about Chris Potter a few years back called Open Minds. He's really great. And he came down to New York. We did it in a day. He followed me around, you know, and he's just capturing me. I didn't even know he was shooting half the time. So then we went to the studio. We had Jaleel and Fema on the video.
Jaleel Shaw.
Fema Ephron, right? Yes. Who play alto sax and bass on the record, respectively. And, you know, it was just a really heartfelt and sincere tribute to them, and something that I really felt could, you know, we hear a lot of stuff about the men in our lives. Father's Day brings up a lot of, you know, conflicting emotions for people. Some people had great relationships with their dad. I was lucky to have that. And some people who might not have even known their fathers, or who had rocky relationships with them. So I just wanted to celebrate, you know, what was great about both of those men, and do it in a way that was just sincere, you know, and hopefully the music pays a befitting tribute to them too.
And it sounds like this. It's Home Free for Peter Joe. It's from the recording by drummer Nate Smith and his band Kinfolk. The recording is called Postcards from Everywhere. You mentioned something to me recently that your father had a certain obsession with footstools.
Yeah, man. He did, man. My dad, God bless him, he had a woodworking shop in our garage, and he had, you know, a lot of really nice gear he bought. You know, and he loved it. And he had a sketchbook full of his, you know, ideas. And, you know, I think that was his creative outlet, you know, and he made a lot of stuff that's in the house, like a lot of stuff. Some of it turned out great. Some of it not, you know, he was a little rough around the edges, but he, you know, always just loved doing it and did it because he loved it. And he made a lot of footstools in the house. There are footstools all over the house.
Are they level?
I mean, different heights, varying, okay. You know, but no, they turned out really good. He was really good at those. Like he, you know, the legs are really beautiful, and like he put these really nice cushions on. It's like really cool. So he was good at that. He was also really good at, he did some really beautiful tables in our home. He, you know, I think he was an artist. He worked as a high school principal most of his life, but he definitely had an artistic pursuit. I think he, which through the woodworking, he pursued that.
And in some sense, he created a step up, if I should extend the metaphor,
okay,
for you.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the artistic side of him was that he loved music.
Yeah.
And so a lot of your early experience with jazz, mm-hmm, and the history of black music,
sure,
came from him.
From him, yeah.
And finds its way in here.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It, that's part of what makes it feel so nostalgic for me, and like such a narrative for me, is because I absorbed those sounds, you know, in the house. You know, he was playing Quincy Jones and Joe Sample and Bob James. It was that period of music in the late 70s, early 80s. before it was commodified as smooth jazz,
right,
there was this period where it was like just instrumental R&B played by great musicians who were playing it very sincerely and recorded beautifully, to the point that when hip hop artists started, when had, you know, access to sampling capability, they reached right for these records and found, you know, all these perfect loops. So yeah, I absorbed all that music, and it sort of comes out in tracks like Bounce or Small Moves or stuff on the record like that. But no, it really came from him. He loved Quincy Jones records. He always said, you know, I love the way they make my speakers sound. I love the way they make my stereo sound. He's like, that was his benchmark for how a record should sound, was a Quincy Jones record. So it starts with him playing records in the house.
Tell me a little bit about Bounce. There are two parts.
There are two parts, yeah. So Bounce is probably the oldest song on the record, because I've been playing that song with Chris Potter's Underground Band for many years before I recorded it. But it is basically a song that has this one little instrumental riff that repeats a few times with some open jamming in between it. And then there's an open sort of solo section at the end, which features Chris Potter on the album. And because we've been playing it so long, and because he's just Chris Potter and he's awesome, but because we've been playing it so long, he just eats it alive on the record, man. He just tears it up. And that second section is sort of a soloist feature there. In my mind, I was thinking about a record like Tutu by Miles Davis, which you would see these tunes that were like just riffs that would repeat with open improvised sections, not really solo sections in between, but where the band would just groove in between these two sections. And I really liked that idea, you know, and then maybe featuring one musician as a soloist in a second part. I just love the idea of that environment, treating the music like a piece of sculpture or something, where it's the parts are the parts. And that's what we kind of stick to, playing the parts. And maybe we sprinkle a little bit of stuff, but the actual piece is just, you know, what the bass is playing, what the guitar is playing, the melody. Those are the parts, and they're fixed, you know. Between those sections, again, like I'm thinking, there's just a point at which we just use those bassline parts, bass, guitar, keys. We use those parts as a launching pad to just sprinkle with, like, small improvisatory ideas, you know. And then we go to the second section where it is more open and a more extended soloist for one player.
Thank you.
Nate Smith, do you find that more recently that you're striving for simplicity in some sense versus, I mean, there's a lot of music that we call jazz that is incredibly complex.
Yeah, yeah.
And in a lot of ways perfectly executed by great musicians like you.
Right.
But more recently, fewer people are getting back to sort of that simple element of a melody that someone can kind of connect to.
Yeah, yeah. I think that there's power in that. I think there's real power in giving people something they can latch on to and take with them. And they can sing in the car, they can sing in the shower, they can sing whistle in the, you know, while they're working or whatever. I do think that, you know, it becomes the sort of soundtrack of your life in a way. Not to be corny, but I do think that there are moments where in your life where you'll think of a melody and you'll think about where you were the first time you heard it, or where you were the first time you sang it, you know, when you were, or where you were the first time you heard it live, or, you know.
It's not a singular sensory experience of just the ear.
No. It's a full...
The ear is sending a signal to your brain.
To your brain, yeah.
And there are a lot of other things that brain remembers.
Absolutely. Your brain remembers every aspect of where you were. You know, I can remember listening to some of those records that my dad used to play. I can remember what mom was cooking in the kitchen, you know, when he was making those records. Like, it's a full body experience. And I do respect and love what musicians are doing who are playing music that's much more complex, because that's a different type of listening experience, you know, where it's almost like you have to invest your whole body into taking it in that moment. But if I see people moving in their seats, or, you know, kind of, if people want to get up and two-step while I'm playing, I have no problem with that, because I feel like that's what music is kind of meant to do. And I really don't have any problem with people having the idea that the music is simple, or that it is, you know, designed to be used again and again, you know, to be listened to again and again and sung again and again. I, you know, that's okay with me. That's totally fine. And I don't think that there's anything about that makes it less of a jazz record.
Do you design songs to last? I mean, some people just kind of say, this is a snapshot of me right now. This is my recording, and I'm going to move on to something else.
Yeah. Whether you design them to last or not, they last forever. Like, this record's going to be around, hopefully, for a long time, and it'll outlive me. And I think that as musicians, and especially as record producers, people who make records, we're in the design business, you know, in the same way that, you know, someone who creates a piece of art or a piece of whatever, that, you know, you're creating something that will be used again and again, and played again and again, and consumed again and again. And you're like, okay, what are the elements of this that I want, you know, people to discover after repeated listenings, repeated use? You know, that's the thing.
As you design something, you have to consider the user experience.
You have to. I mean, I think that's what makes the most successful designer successful, is that they're considering the user, you know? And, and if you're designing it for musicians to use, that's one thing. So if you're designing it for musicians or journalists or critics or whatever to use it in that way, that's totally fine. And
there's nothing wrong with that.
There's nothing wrong with that. But if you're designing it for people who aren't musicians to have access to a musical experience or to use it again and again, that's another thing entirely. Maybe not entirely, but it is another thing. And it is something else that you will consider. I feel like I was lucky in that I was raised around people who weren't musicians, you know, who just enjoyed music. So I have a sense of what people who don't listen to music in a deconstructive way expect from music and what they want from it. So I've kind of think about that as I make records and make tracks. And, you know, I'm always thinking about not only my experience, because I experience it as a fan too, but also think about, man, okay, you know, when I listen to it again and again, I listened to Kenfolk for 2 years before I released it, you know. Well, it was
Were you a little nervous about
it? I was a little nervous, man. No, not at all. Yes, I was very nervous. I was definitely, you know, because it is my first band leader record, because it is, I felt the stakes were really high for me. So but I also knew that I wanted it to be something different from that. It would kind of stick out in the landscape of the jazz records that were coming out. So yeah, I considered that as I listened to it again and again. But getting back to this point of creating music for the audience, considering the audience, I do not think that's a bad thing at all, and I don't think it makes anything less than any other type of music or any other type of expression.
Are you considering the audience when you create these drum loops for the loop loft? serious. Yeah. Because can you just only focus so much on that and then just like, I'm in this groove and I gotta stick it.
Yeah, that's really more what it is. It's like I'm in the groove. I'm experiencing it as a drummer first. But I feel like drummers, we have a very interesting vantage point because so often the drums on any record create the environment.
Oh, yes. I have to tell you, just to interject for a moment, I love drummer records.
Right.
I love Brian Blade and the Fellowship. Yeah. I love Mark Giuliana's beat music.
Absolutely.
I love Antonio Sanchez's recording, Bad Hombre. Yeah. So I always pay particular attention to what's going on with drummers.
Right, right. I feel like when you're behind the kit and the kit is the closest thing to you, you have a very interesting perspective about how the band sounds because, again, I feel like this environment that drummers create with sound is unique to any other instrument, to all the instruments on the bandstand. I mean, it's a very unique place to be. I think that's why you see so many drummers transitioning into like becoming producers and, you know, making records. And because we have this idea that the drum is kind of the center of the environment, the sonic environment. And the events kind of emerge from that, you know. So I'm thinking, you know, as a producer, I'm thinking, yeah, what kind of groove would I want to play? What kind of snare drum sound would I want to play? What kind of snare drum sound would I want to have access to? And so the loop loft thing, you know, shout out to Ryan Gress and everybody at Loop Loft because he's put something together that's really unique. And a lot of producers have hit me up saying, I really love these loops. I love the way it's built. I love the way it's, you know. He makes it so easy for them to use it, but he uses real musicians playing real parts. So, yeah, it's a balance of those two things. I'm thinking about myself as a producer, would I like this? You know what I mean? But I'm also, as a drummer, I just want to execute the groove, you know? So you're kind of on a tightrope, you know? But first things first, I'm always thinking as a drummer. Like, I'm, you know.
But we know the answer to the question, will Nate Smith use Nate Smith on the session?
Who was it? Somebody came up to me the other day and said, man, I heard that you did a Loop Loft record. So I guess that means you're going to be on my next album. I was like,
featuring Nate Smith.
I was like, okay, well, we'll have to work out another deal for that, but that's fine. It's cool. Yeah, man, I haven't done too much programming recently. I've been playing on my own records and demos and stuff, but you know, maybe I'll download my own Lupec. Or maybe I'll download Mark Giuliana's or Eric's or, you know.
Kareem Riggins.
I think, yeah, he's done one. So, you know, there's plenty of guys.
Yeah.
You know, who could, yeah. I'll use their beats, you know, first. You know, put Kareem on my record, you know.
I remember talking to Kareem once and I was like, well, when did you do this? It was for the first one he did, Alone Together.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, I made all this stuff sitting in the bus for Diana Krall on tour.
That's right.
I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, he's that, you know, Kareem. Kareem was another drummer I met. He wasn't a part of Jazz Ahead that year, but I think he had done it the year before. Mm. So he was there hanging out. And he came in the first day, and I saw this kid who had on this, like, U.S. mail cap. And, like, he was so, like, cool and, like, swagged out. And I was like, who is this kid? Like, and Kareem, I think maybe he's a year or so younger than me. So, but I just remember him hanging out. And then finally I introduced myself. He's like, yeah, man, I'm Kareem, man. And I remember he was staying at the same hotel, and even back then he had a stack of CDs and two speakers, and he had, I don't know if he had his beat machine with him or not, but he was just playing me beats, like beat after beat after beat. And he was telling me about, you know, JD before he became Dilla. He was like, you know, yeah, you know, I, you know, he's like, you know, he was like his mentor, and it was amazing, you know. And to see the trajectory he's been on since then, I respect the guy so much. He's really great.
Nate Smith joins us. The recording is Postcards from Everywhere, and it's the band Kinfolk. You have a bit of a different perspective, you think, coming from, you know, the South.
Yeah.
I mean, not coming from a place that's necessarily someone would refer to as the center of the jazz universe.
Right, right. I do think it gives you, I think you have to teach yourself a little more and be a little more curious about things. It's, which is not to suggest that people who are from, you know, musical cities and musical families and aren't curious at all. But I do think that you have to kind of seek out what you want and find musicians who can help you along the way. Yeah, you know, if you're being born in a family, I think I'm the only musician in the history of my family, professional musician. I think we had some you know, people who said my dad sang a little bit, my mom sings in the choir and that kind of thing, but no one who had pursued it as a career. So I was kind of flying solo in that way. My brother is an artist too, and he is a visual artist. He works in TV now, but he was the only other artist in the family. So I could kind of like emulate what he was doing and try to figure out, okay, well, you know, how do you work freelance? How do you, you know, not have a steady paycheck? How do you do, you know? So you learn things like that by doing. But in terms of learning about the music, I think it is something that you have to be really intentional about and just study everything that you come into contact with. My way in was just mimicking everything I saw that interests me, just learning how to do it, you know?
You have a couple of vocalists on this recording. Yeah. Can you talk about who they are? They're on different songs, mm-hmm. and why you chose them to be part of Gin Vocal?
Alma Watt is the featured vocalist on two songs on the album. And she's also the lyricist for all the songs that have lyrics. I met Alma in 2011. I was producing an R&B record for my friend Gerard Anthony, who lives in Richmond. And Alma sang background vocal on a track. And I went to see her perform with another artist, and she just jumped off the stage. She was great, you know. And I thought, okay, there's something about her voice and the way she delivers the lyric that I love. And I got to know her, and I listened to her own music. I listened to her own lyrics, and I was like, man, I really love the way she writes. She writes in a way that's very transparent. Like, there's not a lot of fluff in these lyrics.
Sunday morning, she starts to rise, waking up slowly. Open window, sun in my eyes, feeling the wind blow. My tree.
Gretchen Parlato, who's featured on one of the songs, I never had a chance to work with her, but I'd been a fan of hers for a long time. And she's another singer who is not afraid to traverse into the R&B territory. You know, her stuff with Robert, the collaborations in the
SWV.
SWV, I know. Yeah, she flipped that song. And
she nailed it, man.
Really. Beautiful arrangement. Yeah. And she sang it beautifully, and she sang it respectfully, too. It wasn't like she was like, okay, let me just do this R&B thing and, you know, whatever. She sang it like she meant it, you know? And I just really thought that was a very cool and courageous move for a jazz singer, you know? So I'd always really admired her and wanted her on the record, and we found a way to work together on this one. So I'm psyched to have both of them.
Now I turn the pages of a memory lost, just coming back from long ago. Still I turn the page, even though it's frayed around the edge. As I turn the pages and I let them take.
The recording is called Postcards from Everywhere, Kinfolk, Nate Smith, the drummer and composer and now band leader. has this process, and now that you've been out in the world with the band a little bit, has this discouraged you? Do you want to go run back to the drum chair and just say, I'm going to just do
side
this?
Man. Yeah, I'll just be the side. I tell you, it's a whole other ball of wax. Louise Holland, Chris Potter's manager, Dave Holland's manager, she told me, she said, you know, leading a band is a whole other kettle of fish. That was her thing. That was her metaphor. And it's true. There are a lot of things you have to consider, and there's a lot more money you spend. But, you know, I'm actually enjoying it. You know, this will be our first tour that we're starting. And we'll go out and we'll play these gigs, and some of the gigs are doing very well. They're selling very well, and hopefully we'll have some enthusiastic audiences, and that will be rewarding, I think.
What makes it worth it?
Well, man, it's a good question. Hearing these musicians play this music, to me, that's really what makes it worth it. Like hearing John Cowart play this music, hearing, you know, Jaleel play so beautifully night after night, and just, you know, because I wrote the music with these guys in mind. I wrote it with Jaleel and Fema and Amma in mind, and Jeremy Most, who's on the record but is not on the tour, he's also a big factor in the record, and Chris Bowers, who's on the record too. I mean, I always write and conceive of these shows, and you know, with the musicians in mind. So the most rewarding thing is, you know, casting the right people and having them show up and deliver, you know. And as a sideman, you realize the value of that too. It just really makes, I think it makes you a better, being a good sideman makes you a better leader. And I think being a good band leader makes you a better sideman too. Because I think you learn what it really means to occupy both of those spaces, you know. So that's the most rewarding thing is having great musicians on stage who you feel like they've got your back and they're going to deliver the music beautifully.
Since you said the word beautifully, I have one final question for you. And it arises out of me seeing one of your posts on Facebook. Mm-hmm. I think it was in July at some point. Mm-hmm. And I guess it was getting pretty thick. You had this really kind of beautiful yet diffuse photograph. Mm-hmm. And you wrote at length, but then at the end you said, I'm just here for the beauty.
That's true, man.
What is the beauty that you're here for?
You know, that's a great question, man. You don't know always until you see it. It for me, I think the beauty is a moment of truth or something that feels true. When you're on stage with the musicians, and there might be, even if it lasts for 5-10 seconds, there might be this moment where everybody's playing and you really know that we're all vibrating on the same frequency. We're all in the same place. That's the beauty that you're there for. When you are on the road and it's a really tough day and you take a 10-minute walk and you look up and you see this beautiful skyline, you're reminded, I'm doing what I love to do. You know, no matter how tough the day, no matter how delayed the flights were, what bags they lost or whatever, how rude the airline check-in staff was, no matter what that is, I'm still here for this beautiful sunset or this beautiful venue or these beautiful people who came out with their hearts open to receive the music. That's really what you're there for, you know. And I can say this, man, also having worked with Dave, there were moments, man, especially early in my tenure with Dave, like we'd have these really tough travel days, getting up at like 4:30 in the morning to go to the airport, and just tough. And we would get to the gig, and we'd play that night, and Dave would take a bass solo in the middle of the thing. And I would think to myself, you know, Dave has been up just as long as I've been up. He's been awake just as long as I've been awake. He's done more. He's had more responsibility than me. And listen to how beautifully he's playing, you know. Like, he never let it deter him from the mission, which was to just tell the truth with the music, you know. And that's really what you're here for, man. That's really, I think, our job. There is a component of storytelling and truth-telling to being a musician that we cannot lose sight of, especially now. We need to tell the truth now in profound ways, you know.
As you continue to go out into the world and find beauty, just do me one favor. Promise me something.
Absolutely.
You'll send a postcard.
Absolutely. I certainly will. I certainly will.
Postcards from Everywhere is the recording from Kinfolk. Nate Smith joins us. Thank you so much for being with us.
Man, thank you, Josh. I appreciate you, brother. Thank you.